just having recently traveled to England, and I think some of the difference for Americans is that it's not filled with sugar, preservatives, and artificial. And you look around and you don't see a tremendous amount of obesity. I didn't see advertisements for healthcare blaring out everywhere, nor did I hear sirens blaring all the time whenever I was in London. This was just a different experience. And so when you stop and say, why are these things happening? If we continue to medicalize what is essentially a lifestyle issue in our country, I believe we are going to be unsuccessful because we will be able to supersize our way out of any social drivers of health program that allows us to get care to provide tertiary quaternary care on the back end. We've got to provide the tertiary quaternary care now, but we've got to take a hard look at ourselves as a society to say, why is it that we as the most advanced society on the planet, why is it that we have such dramatic healthcare issues?
Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Welcome to episode 25 of Pemba On Demand, The Path to Excellence, a Physician Executive's Story of Challenges and Successes. We are releasing the live stream from our September 17th episode with Dr. Jay Grider for this episode of the podcast today. Dr. Grider is an anesthesiologist by training who assumed a variety of leadership roles at the University of Kentucky. In this episode, Jay shares his thoughts and perspectives on physician leadership, the growth of UK healthcare during his tenure, challenges and priorities he faced as a physician leader, and the focus on improving quality of care at UK healthcare. He also discusses his thoughts on the value of an MBA for physicians and managing a 12-month MBA program. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to today's Pemba On Demand live stream. I'm Norm Chapin, your host for the live stream. The live stream today is allowing alumni to join using an integrated Zoom link. We will have you muted during the live stream, but if you would like to ask a question, please type the letter Q, colon, followed by your question in the chat. We'll be addressing the questions at various points during the live stream. I would also encourage you to enter any comments you have into the chat as we are discussing today's topic. I'm really excited to bring today's topic to you. The topic and title for the live stream today is The Path to Excellence, A Physician Executive's Story of Challenges and Successes. Dr. Jay Grider is our guest for the live stream today. Jay is currently the Chief Quality Officer at UK Healthcare. He served for nearly 6 years as Chief Physician Executive for UK Healthcare and has held other leadership roles in the organization as well. Jay is also a professor at the University of Kentucky. He attended Georgetown College in Kentucky, followed by his medical school at Ohio University and University of Kentucky. He did actually a combined DO and PhD program and then completed his residency at University of Kentucky and Ohio State University in anesthesia, and then completed his MBA at the University of Tennessee in 2013. Jay, I'm very excited to have you on the live stream today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Norm. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. It's great to have you here. I really look forward to our show today and to the insights that you're going to bring to the audience. So thank you very, very much for taking your time to join us. I know you're out of town at a conference, hence the background in the room right now, the hotel curtains, but it's really a pleasure to have you here. I wonder if you could start by sharing a little bit of information about UK healthcare with us. What is the organization like? How big is it? And give us some of the background on the organization.
So UK Healthcare currently is 1,200 beds, over 1,000 employed physicians, 500 APPs. It's about a $4.2 billion system, and it has just acquired a hospital system in Ashland, Kentucky, King's Daughters, and in Moorhead, Kentucky, St. Clair Regional Medical Center. Medical school has four locations across the state in Bowling Green, Northern Kentucky, Moorhead, and in the Lexington campus. So it is a growing enterprise. 15, 20 years ago, UK was a 320-bed and shrinking sleepy academic medical center that was awakened under the direction and visionary leadership of a guy named Mike Karp, who had come from UCLA. And he realized that the people of Kentucky did not have a resource for the high complex medical needs of Kentucky. And so he thought, he brought about a vision where no citizen would have to leave the state of Kentucky to receive tertiary, quaternary, subspecialty care. And so turned UK from a 320-bed sleepy academic medical center, which was, quite frankly, it was failing in some ways, into a juggernaut that is taking its place in the regional makeup. Sort of, we consider our borders to the edge of what Ohio State does, to the edge of what Virginia does, to the edge of what Indiana and Vanderbilt, and then the West to the edge of what Washington University does. So we have a pretty wide focus.
It sounds like a pretty amazing transformation to go from a 320-bed hospital to the size of an organization and the catchment area that you currently have.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I would not even say that those 320 beds were all that frequently completely occupied either. So we've gone from that to the largest transfer center in the country in Vizient. So we get over 23,000 transfers a year, so on 44,000 discharges. So over half of our volume comes through transfer, which mm-hmm. is an amazing statistic whenever you think about it. How do you care for patients that have been moved on from another hospital more than 50% of the time? So it is quite a daunting task.
So from a primary care standpoint, maybe setting aside the tertiary aspect of UK healthcare right now, what percentage of the Kentucky population does UK play an integral role in providing primary care?
So we think of ourselves in terms of three markets: the local Fayette County market, which is where the University of Kentucky Medical Center is, then a secondary market, which are the surrounding counties, and then obviously the tertiary market, which is out into the state and a touch beyond. So in Fayette County, we have the largest population of primary care physicians. And even though it would probably come as a surprise to some of the local health systems, we actually have more patients impaneled at UK than any other health system in the county. We sort of soft sell that because we don't want to be seen as predatory to our partners at all. We want to be a support mechanism for the entire state, but we do have the largest impanelment in Fayette County. Once you get out into the secondary and tertiary markets, our primary care reach does not obviously have as much extensive reach, because primary care is a local phenomenon in many ways. But given the critical nature of illness, because of the degree of sickness that is found within the state, we sort of function as the primary care. A lot of people don't actually have a primary care physician. We're managing pretty significant disease processes, heart failure, pulmonary lung disease, renal failure, cirrhosis, for them in a rather subspecialty way. So it is a different kind of model for complex care and for primary care, just because of the nature of the infrastructure of our state.
So in your role, you were in the chief physician executive role for almost 6 years. At what point in this transformation of UK healthcare did you step into that role? And what were some of the biggest challenges or priorities that you faced as you stepped into the chief physician executive position?
Let me back up just a touch and say why I got involved in administration at all. So I was a fellow with a very dynamic, nationally known interventional pain physician, and UK had built a practice for him that was designed to maximize revenue and volume and throughput, but it had succeeded in losing a couple million dollars a year. And they did that for 3 or 4 years, and they gave that individual the opportunity to go into private practice, and then they handed the practice over to me. People said, "Congratulations, you're now in charge of the chronic pain division," and it was just me. And I said, "Well, I don't know how much congratulations are in order. I've always been in charge of me, so I didn't really know that was necessarily much of a much of a promotion, but we sat around and they felt so sorry for me because they put me in a hallway. They took us out of this $4 million building and they put me in a hallway that they were storing mattresses in a month before that. And so it was such a dingy, dismal facility. And we went to work that we had 20 employees. They let 8 go with the previous physician. They let 2 or 3 go, and they gave me the 4 employees that had HR concerns. They didn't want to fire them because they were afraid of the HR pushback. So that I got the 4 worst employees. And so we just started building. They did put me in a leadership development program, and I was introduced to the concept of Lean Six Sigma. And looking at Lean Six Sigma, I was sitting on literally on the back of a napkin. I still have it as they were teaching value stream mapping. And I thought, hey, I could see 12 patients an hour if everything went exactly perfectly. And I went back to our staff and said, hey, I think we could see 12 patients an hour if everything went perfectly. And they said, we're seeing 3 an hour. What are you talking about? You're smoking crack. And I said, okay, how about if we shoot for something in the middle? How about if we shoot for 7 or 8? And sure enough, we started doing that. And all of a sudden, all this productivity started going through this dismal, dingy space. And people started saying, why can an anesthesiologist run an ambulatory clinic? And I just was running it like I would if I owned it. So I went, we needed to build a procedure room. We could be even more efficient if we built a procedure room in our clinic. And I needed $80,000. And so I remember going to the halls of power to ask for $80,000 to renovate space within our clinic for a procedure room. And I thought that was a ton of money. I didn't realize that that was like the spend on consultant lunches for that day. So I remember walking across, you know, mahogany floors and through, you know, marble tile and to get to a place to ask that wallpaper wouldn't hang off the walls and the carpet wouldn't be rolled up. And I said to myself, I want to get to a place where the physician voice for good ideas, somebody will get behind and champion that. And so I started working in the ambulatory space. Admittedly, a lot of the hospital had been built out from a CMO standpoint. So the ambulatory space was the Wild West. You could sort of get your feet in because nobody really wanted to fool with it. And we began working through that. And eventually there was Dr. Karp retired and a CEO was hired at UK who had a more ambulatory focus. And so that was the opportunity then to create a modern funds flow process in a medical group and work in the ambulatory space to try to tool things. And that's how I became the chief physician executive. But I think it's important to go back to say, you know, it was really Lean Six Sigma, which was the thing that captured my attention at first of the power of possibility. And so people say, what do you do? And I say, I spend all day long trying to translate CEO and CFO ease into physicians and translate physician speak to CEO and CFO so that they understand the value proposition for all of it.
So, and I was going to talk a little bit about this, was the leadership development course that UK put you through, was that sort of like a mini MBA program or was that really focused on process improvement? And is that where you dipped your toe into the Lean Six Sigma world?
I would say, you know, it's like those little taster scoops that you get at Baskin Robbins, right? It was, hey, take a little taste of lean, see if you like that. Oh, you don't like lean, do you? Well, let's see if you like finance, you know? So yes, it was a little bit of an exposure to lots of things, but it was really the process and the rigor of process improvement that captured my attention.
So as when you moved into the chief physician executive role, had UK already expanded its scope and catchment area significantly during that time that you were sort of working in the ambulatory world?
Yes. Yeah, so Mike Karp came to UK in 2003. We had 12,000 discharges in 2003. He'd gotten that up to 19,000 by 2008. So from 2008, there's a sort of the steady march to 44,000 discharges from 19,000 discharges. And so we had the first thing that we had stopped doing, we had a group of academic physicians who, if you called them, they would say, no, we're not taking that. We don't want to do that. We don't want to take that. And really Mike Karp's thing was, we will say no, we will not use the word no to anybody if they're requesting our services. And so we just kept packing patients in and packing patients in. So yes, that process had already started. And admittedly, what made it successful was this concepting that we need to be the tertiary quaternary resource for the state. At the same time, people began to say, there needs to be an ambulatory footprint to care for some of that. And so the concepting that we needed to expand an ambulatory footprint became an imperative. At first, it wasn't necessarily that we had to expand a primary care footprint, because we did not want to be seen as predatory in any way. Send us your sick, you're tired, you're hungry, and we'll get them back to you with a nice note sometimes, usually. With Epic, it's better. But eventually, you realized we had to build out a certain degree of primary care base, because once sick patients were transferred, no longer could primary care really take care of them. So it was really secondary care, primary care that was that was taking place. The primary care taking care of really, really sick people. So that's sort of the change that's occurred.
So it strikes me that the transition from not accepting a lot of outside transfers, especially as it relates to many of the medical staff, to going to never saying no, is a relatively significant change. What was your medical staff's reaction to that ask or that tell?
So, you know, there had been a lot of people that had been entrenched there, and they did not necessarily want to take that tact. Dr. Karpf had a way of persuading you, though. I'll just leave it at that. Persuading was effective. Every day as the CEO, he had the transfer report on his desk, and he would go through the transfer list of denied transfers. And you know, if you denied a transfer, he was going to be on the phone asking you why that transfer was denied. And so that was a very effective way of changing that culture pretty quickly. Now, eventually, we got to the place where the demand for transfers were greater than our ability to accept them. And there has to be some sort of a triage process. And so that's why we're undertaking a $2.4 billion building campaign right now to get to about 1,500 beds, so that our goal is to never say no when the state or the region asks for our help.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So you talked about the transition from clinician into clinic administrator into sort of a chief medical officer role in the ambulatory space, and then on to chief physician executive. What would you say was your biggest challenge during that transition? You talked about the role of speaking both CEO language and physician language and vice versa, translating for each other. Would you say that was the biggest challenge? Were there other challenges that you found? And what were some of those issues that you had to navigate during that transition?
So actually, I would say something different. If you really learn and understand the ambulatory space, a mentor once said, people don't go to the hospital for a doctor. They go to the hospital because they need nursing care, which if you think about it, is really true. You get episodic physician care. Mostly it's nursing care, but people only come to the clinic because they want to see a physician or an APP. And so you really understand physician productivity mindset, although there are a few physicians that they just go to clinic in order to book cases, and they try to be there as infrequently as possible. But for the most part, the physician sees the clinic as their domain. They also see the hospital as their domain, but there's a whole lot of other players that are absolutely necessary. So understanding physician productivity, physician mindset was really my strength. That's what I brought to the chief physician executive role. And I think that's why they brought me in, was because I was the only one who really understood physician finance from a RVU standpoint deeply, and who could construct a working, you know, funds flow process. What I didn't understand quite as well was a lot of the hospital, the deep hospital metrics at that time, you know, about cauti-clabsy mortality, you know, those sorts of things, how to improve length of stay. So I had to take an accelerated course in that in order to be successful. The CMO at the time was very gracious and helpful, because all the CMOs reported into that role. We're trying to create a unified clinical system that bridged ambulatory and inpatient. But I will say ambulatory and inpatient are very different beasts and take different skill sets to lead. So
as chief physician executive, did you report directly to the CEO for UK Healthcare?
Yes, sir. Yes. We call it the executive vice president for health affairs, but yes, essentially the CEO for the health system.
And then all the physician leadership in the organization reported up through you.
It did, yes. Okay. So I was in a dyad relationship with the chief operating officer, and together we administrated the clinical aspects of UK.
Okay. For the last year now, you've been in a new role. You've been the chief quality officer for UK Healthcare. What were some of the similarities and differences between that role of chief quality officer and chief physician executive?
Yeah, so just a bit of context. I think something that academic health centers wrestle with is, and I've heard it at Vizient here, just walking around literally from listening to executives from one health system talk to an executive from another health system. And one of the things that's really difficult from a cultural standpoint is the academic medical center closed shop and bringing on the employed physician into the culture. And there's a lot of different ways to do it, but there's a tension that is there. And as I was listening to them describe that, we were certainly feeling that tension because we had not yet gone and gotten employed physician groups, which is what a lot of other health systems are doing, buying groups or either starting to hire employed physicians whose only purpose is to see patients. Because while academic work is fantastic, there is only so much teaching that needs to be done. There's only so much that needs to be managed on behalf of the medical school. And really true clinical researchers are a different breed, sort of the hobbyist, the triple threat person. That's hard to do. But that tension of hiring clinicians only in, sometimes the academic medical center feels like being competed with by this other group. And so managing that tension is difficult. As I said, I'm even hearing it here. We were contemplating how we wanted to do that. And the chief physician executive role was designed to sort of bridge that gap and start to bring on employed physicians. Our health system decided that we didn't really want to do that, that we wanted to stick with the academic model and that we wanted to, and I think it was the right call for us. I think it was a wise choice to do. So some of what I was doing was given back over to the College of Medicine, and I retained the quality piece of it. And so that was something that I had been doing and actually probably was my love. I did the other things so that I could get the opportunity to do something that I think really actually impacts patients in a true manner, which is how do you, who stands up every day and starts to think about how we're going to improve the quality and the safety on behalf of our patients.
So you bring up an interesting point. The complexity of the healthcare environment has certainly increased dramatically. And when we were talking in preparation for this show, you mentioned a decision that was made in Kentucky when Obamacare rolled out regarding expanding, I guess I would call it an expansion of Medicaid, although the state of Michigan had a different Medicaid expansion. But can you talk a little bit about what Kentucky did with the rollout of Obamacare and how that has impacted the focus of UK and quality?
Sure. So flashback to 2008. So you have 4.4 million citizens in Kentucky, of which 1.1 million were uninsured, had no form of health care insurance at all. And then you had another 1.2 million who had employer plans, but the cost of healthcare was pulling many small businesses down. So with the advent of Obamacare, the governor at the time, Steve Beshear, in what I think was a very forward-thinking way of managing, opened up probably one of the most open accesses. There were five states that completely opened up to managed Medicaid. And so a lot of small businesses allowed their employees to transition to manage Medicaid. So a lot of the stigma, which could be around Medicaid, was going away. It was a lot of families, a lot of your rank and file, younger family employees, and a lot of the hardworking citizens of the state who just could not afford health care. And so we put over 900,000 people who were uninsured. So only 200,000 people were left that were uninsured in the state at that time. And so that created a huge demand. They had not fixed the payment system. And so there were a lot of health systems that I wouldn't say they refused to see Medicare, but there were, let's just say, some hoops. And so how do you create the access then, now that you've got the demand and you've solved one problem? There's always, you know, you peel back a layer of the onion, there's always three other layers. And so a way to fix that access was to create a value-based care plan, which ensured that the university-based systems that were active at the time were able to continue to take care of the citizens of Kentucky who'd just been newly insured. So there was a Medicaid value-based care program that was created in 2016 to ensure that the financing was there to allow access and to dramatically improve the quality of the care that was delivered. So we were only one of five states that had opted into it, but it ends up being a really strong decision because there's almost no self-pay in Kentucky, and the payment systems are such that health systems can survive if they are in this program with a pretty significant Medicaid population. And it allows you to continue to create access and expand and deliver cutting edge treatments to the poorest and to the middle and rank class and rank and file in our state who might not otherwise be afforded care.
So do you have a sense of what the financial impact of getting involved in that value-based care system was for UK healthcare?
Sure. So UK healthcare went through three major transformations. So we were essentially a very small market cap health system with a break-even or negative margin saying no to a lot of patients. So just saying yes to more patients between 2003 and 2012 dramatically increased our margins. It's amazing what taking care of patients will do for your margin. So then we began to hit a second equilibrium point where, okay, now our expenses are going up and we can't grow our way out of our expense growth to take care of these people. So we invested heavily in pharmacy resources, and our pharmacy resources are fantastic. We have one of the most advanced pharmacy programs in the country. Our pharmacy schools rank third in the country, and they are quite innovative. And so we generated another $600-700 million in pharmacy revenue, and that created around $40-50 million of margin. So essentially, we were break even on healthcare and profitable on pharmacy. I joke that we had become Walgreens or CVS. We were a pharmacy attached to a major health system. Nobody thought that was funny except the pharmacist. So then pharmacy revenues continued to erode and expenses continued to grow. And the Medicaid value-based care program was conceived through some strong legislative activity from the state in conjunction with our federal government. Really a very visionary leader named Mark Birdwhistle said, hey, we have an opportunity here to help the citizens of Kentucky in a very innovative program. And so with very stringent value-based measures, we have a program that is worth several hundred million dollars that, if we manage it correctly, creates margin that allows us to continue to grow and create access on behalf of the citizens of Kentucky. And so that has been the third major inflection point from a financial standpoint for UK healthcare.
So has the promise of the value-based care and the improved outcomes that the government kind of tied to this additional revenue, tell us a little bit about how successful UK healthcare has been in terms of actually improving the outcomes in the Kentucky population.
Sure. So, you know, and it's not just UK healthcare. I would say U of L Health is also involved in it. There is a sister institution. U of L Health has a children's hospital through Norton's Hospital in Louisville. So it's a little bit more of a hybrid system than we are as a contained system. But they are wonderful partners in this. So it's not just us. I need to be sure and give credit where credit's due. But when you look at things like statin measure across the country, if you look at commercial payers, Medicaid, and Medicare, it'll all be about the same, about a 50% success rate at getting the right patient in the denominator on a statin. When you look at well-child visits, it floats around 50%. The Medicaid program in the state, in conjunction with the federal government, said, if we're going to give you these resources, you're going to do better than that. So our well-child visit number, as our goal, is tagged at 90%. 90% of children between the ages of 0 to 15 months, 15 months to 3 years, and then 3 years to 6 years, have this goal as that's put out there for us as the target. When you think about getting 90% of children between 0 and 15 months in a Medicaid population in for well-child visits, that is a daunting task. When you think about getting what is traditionally a non-compliant population on statins, controlling blood pressure, getting A1C below, seven, eliminating opiate use. The opiate thing is really the big success story. We have two patients on high-dose opiates in our health system. We purchased a health system in Ashland. They had over 2,000 patients on high-dose opiates. So these sorts of programs really dramatically work. As a matter of fact, the opiate measure is one of those things that's a be careful what you wish for. We only had 137 Medicaid patients on opiates, period, and only two on high-dose opiates. And the secretary said, we want the opiate percentage to be less than 1%. And I'm like, it's 1.5%, but it's two people. You know, I need to cut someone in half in order to meet this measure. I can't. So we finally got them to go, yeah, you're right. You've only got 137 patients out of 1.4 million ambulatory visits on opiates. You're probably doing okay. Yeah, it is a huge success story. So,
yeah.
But anyway.
Just thinking about the amount of effort that goes into taking people who are used to using opioids for pain who are dependent, and it's a problem we've all dealt with, but it's a very challenging task for the clinicians to sort of walk them through that process. You must have invested a tremendous amount of time, effort, training for physicians in terms of how to have those conversations. And I assume you must, I mean, did you build some type of a support team to help the physicians with that process as well?
A little bit, but my research has been on opiate de-escalation. And so some of that was just inherent to what we were doing here at UK. UK has a long history of, like, the opiate receptor was described by a pharmacologist at UK. The term opiate-induced hyperalgesia was introduced through an experimental model at UK. So we have a long history of opiate research and sort of cutting-edge thinking about that. So that one wasn't as hard. But things like readmissions that we're working on right now, that's really the big story. We are working now on, which is a Medicaid value-based care goal, but it's also a huge goal on the hospital side. Mm-hmm. You know, we're working, we have a lady, as we're diving in patient and saying, what is going on in our population? Just a lady that comes to mind who's been readmitted 24 times this year, and she's on dialysis and difficulty getting appointments arranged. And so we're sitting there, and our hospitalist team, I was sitting outside the door, our hospitalist team went in and said, you know, Mrs. X, you really need to go to your appointments now, you know, because it's really, really important, because if you don't go to your appointments, you're going to get sick. And they walked out, and her son looked at her and said, they're a bunch of idiots, aren't they? And we heard that, and we're like, I guess we are a bunch of idiots. We went in and we just asked her, I said, you know, why do you keep coming to the ED to get dialysis? And she said, well, I can't get, it takes 3 days to arrange the transportation, and I can't get them there for my next dialysis appointment. So I just call 911 and they bring me to the ED and I get dialysis. I went home and I was grumbling to my wife about it. I said, can you believe that? You know, somebody who can't manage, you know, to figure that. And she said, what are you complaining about? She said, this lady has everything figured out. She has a way to get to dialysis every 3 days. You just don't like it. You've got to figure out a different system. And as most things with the beautiful woman that I married, she was right. And so I started thinking, okay, so how do we help you, you know, to navigate these things? And that's where our pop health teams comes in to try to help navigate some of this readmission work. But could talk all day about length of stay improvements, mortality improvements, yeah, and readmission work as well. So,
well, it seems like, too, one of the challenges we face, of course, as our population is aging out and as our incidence and prevalence of chronic disease in that population continues to escalate, I guess the question is, from UK's standpoint, are there efforts to focus in the ambulatory world sort of more upstream? And it seems like eventually we're just kind of being hit by this tsunami of chronically ill, obese, hypertensive, cardiac, renal failure patients that are really overwhelming us in many ways from the hospital side.
Well, absolutely. So, you know, just having recently traveled to England, and, you know, people talk about the English food and how horrible it is. And I think some of the difference for Americans is that it's not filled with sugar, preservatives, and artificial. And you look around and you don't see a tremendous amount of obesity. You see some doughiness. There's English doughiness, but you don't see, you know, real obesity. And the other thing that really struck me was I didn't see advertisements for healthcare blaring out everywhere, nor did I hear sirens blaring all the time whenever I was in London. This was just a different experience. And so when you stop and say, why are these things happening? You know, and yes, there is a tsunami coming, but if we continue to medicalize what is essentially a lifestyle issue in our country, I believe, you know, that we are going to be unsuccessful, because we will be able to supersize our way out of any social drivers of health program that allows us to get care to provide tertiary coronary care on the back end. We've got to provide the tertiary coronary care now, but we've got to take a hard look at ourselves as a society to say, why is it that we as the most advanced society on the planet, why is it that we have such dramatic healthcare issues? And I'm starting to preach, so I will stop that. But I think that we have to figure out at the source of why we are getting our lifestyle in the way that it is. But yes, it is a tsunami, and the social drivers of health programs that we are putting in place, the Medicaid value-based care program has been demanding that we start to examine social drivers of health. And so we have pretty sophisticated mechanisms. Like, for instance, we had a homeless individual who was readmitted 56 times for paralysis. And just by asking our resource teams, okay, are we capable of getting housing? Well, turns out there's 113 agencies in Fayette County that provide low-income housing. How much would it cost? You know, it's probably expensive, right? Well, it's subsidized. So between $65 and $8,700 a year, you can provide housing. How much are we spending on 56 admissions? Yeah. It's probably a touch more. Yeah. So some of it is just getting the resources and the issue aligned. And so that's why I'm really gratified that our legislators and our leaders around healthcare in the state are having some of these hard questions.
That's great. Well, thank you for your comments on that. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about advice that you might give to physicians who really want to have an impact larger than in the examination room, and they're considering transitioning into some type of leadership role because of an opportunity that they've become aware of in their organization. It sounds like you kind of jumped into the role just to try to problem solve a situation you were faced with. What is your recommendation now, looking back at those 15 or 20 years of your career, to young physicians who are coming up who really have a passion and a drive for making big changes or for getting involved in leadership?
You know, you said something and it triggers. So I love the story of Jody Crane. Everybody's heard the story of Jody Crane at UT, right? So, you know, fixing his emergency department and realized that there are so many external forces that were impacting his efforts to improve his emergency department. So he had to go up on the eighth floor and he had to fix the eighth floor. And eventually people said, hey, you're fixing things. You want to do that full time, you know. One of the anesthesiology leaders in the country, you know, sort of worked his way out of the PACU to the floor, you know, because the PACU was backed up, the OR was backed up, worked his way out to the floor, started solving problems on the floor. People say, why is an anesthesiologist able to fix, you know, these issues on the floor? Well, it's because, you know, it started with a problem. I didn't want to sit with patients boarding in my operating room because they couldn't get in the PACU. So I think all good physician leaders start from what I will call their Popeye moment, right? In every Popeye cartoon, there's this moment where Popeye says, I've had all I can stands and I can't stands no more. And from that comes a series of actions to begin to just quietly fix things. And as you quietly fix things, you're not doing it for any other reason. The most selfish motive you have is, I can't work in this environment anymore, so I'm going to be the one who fixes it. And whenever you start with an altruistic motive like that, when your calling is clear about why you're doing it, and it's not about position, power, or authority, or money, it's about just literally, I've got to do something. It's the bias to action that creates good physician leaders. So I hear a lot of medical students who talk about, I'm going to get my MBA, you know, or people who are miserable in practice wanting to transition to administration. Let me just tell you, if you're miserable in the easiest thing I do is practice. It's by far the easiest, simplest, go home at 4 o'clock, leave the day somewhat behind kind of existence. But if your calling is clear and you have that moment where you say, I now understand and I'm going to set out, sounds a bit cheesy, but on the hero's journey of trying to fix it, then that works. When you start out with a, I think I'd like to be in an administrative role. Let me just tell you, people smell that coming from a mile away, and it doesn't seem to work. I know people who get there, and sometimes they're the leaders. We go, how did this person get here? Maybe they have a magnetic personality, or they're charming, or they, you know, I don't know how it happens. But the people who truly make a difference and who truly don't burn out are the ones who say, I'm getting up every day because I'm driven by something that is intrinsic to me, but is also well beyond me. So that's my suggestion. I would search for my why about something I'm truly passionate about. I'm truly passionate about changing X. Okay, well, that'll last. That'll work. And let me tell you, X will become X to the eighth power as you go along, because all you'll find as you start working on one problem is 5,000 more. So you won't solve that and go, well, that was nice. I guess I'll retire. You will only be given more to do. So.
One of my biggest fears is, of course, as I get older, I think about the legacy of all the work I've done in quality and process improvement. But because it's a never-ending journey, it is hard to find that endpoint at which you can say, okay, I've achieved everything that needs to be done, and now I can feel comfortable moving into retirement. I just have come to the realization that when I retire, there will still be a lot of things that I have on my to-do list, my projects, my bucket list in the workplace that are probably not going to be, it's not going to be a finite end to my journey and saying, okay, I've got this all mapped out. It's where it needs to be.
Absolutely. You know, something happened during COVID. I was walking through our ED and it was, you know, there was trauma going on and everybody was tense. And I saw an interaction where a young transport person in our health system was helping a lady, and she could have been 40 years of age. She could have been 60 years of age. There's sort of a weatheredness to some of our people in our state. And they were clearly from very different backgrounds. I'll just leave it at that. They were from opposite ends of the spectrum in every way that you could describe it. And they were getting ready to go somewhere. And he said, don't you worry about a thing. I've got you. And you could see her shoulders slump. And she patted him on the hand. And off they went to the CT scan or wherever it was they were going. And I thought, that's a perfect picture of what I want to be the legacy of our health system. And that is, we create a system where you can rest back into the arms of another. And I tell people every day in our state, there's a child who wakes up and they've been lethargic and they've gone to their pediatrician, but the pediatrician in the small town doesn't know what's going on. And they've been sent to UK, and there's a family that's going to get a hard diagnosis and they're going to have to manage, or there's a 50-year-old who gets a bad diagnosis, or there's an accident that happens with a 21-year-old. And these people will lay back into the arms of the healthcare system that we have created and that we manage. And will that system, in their time of need, provide them comfort, or will it be one more source of frustration and aggravation in the course of that pivotal moment for that family? And it's a choice we get to make every day. Can we create a system that is truly that focused? And yes, every day entropy tears it apart, and every day there are forces that are at work that degrade that level of ability. But the rewarding thing is that whenever you see a culture that will outlive what it is that you're talking about. And I didn't create the culture. I'm just a part of it. You know, the culture was, heck, we're not going to say no to anybody. Well, that created the culture. But those things, they do endure. And I think what you have to come to as a professional is, when you work for an institution, the institution can't love you. It's weird. You can love it. It can't love you. And so you just have to be okay with the fact that it's going to at some point move on from you. And that's where you have to be really clear about your own personal calling and why you did it. And you have to find within yourself the inner work that says, I have participated in something dramatic and amazing, And that is my calling.
That's great. Appreciate that. Excuse me. So we've talked a little bit about a lot of different areas. And one thing that strikes me as we're talking is for any organization that has gone through the number of transformations that UK Healthcare has gone through as you're there, I'm sure that there have been many leadership changes and transitions in leadership while you were there. We know that for many CEOs, for many physician leaders in healthcare organizations, in contrast to people who are practicing clinically, who have a tremendous longevity within a healthcare organization generally, once you move into the administrative suite, it seems like your chances of surviving 5 to 10 years is in question. How, you've been at UK Healthcare in leadership roles for a long time. What do you feel about your approach or your personality that has allowed you to remain there and be successful there?
Yeah, you know, Sue, a lot of times I've thought, I'm going to go someplace else. And I thought to myself, I don't care about length of stay at, you know, our Sisters of the Miserable. You know, I mean, more than I care about length of stay here, you know, I don't care about, you know, the things for me, as long as there's interesting work to do, I'd always said, it doesn't matter what it is that you give me to do, as long as it is of value to do. And so having the opportunity to put those values to the test, do you really mean what it is that you say? You know, what is important to you, your own personal advancement, or doing work that is valuable with people that you care about and that you enjoy? And so, yes, there is a lot of turnover a lot of times. People come and go. These jobs, we all know people in the administrative suite. Everybody, and I'm getting ready to say this, and there's going to be a face that flashes in your mind when I say it. There's that person that you think their main job is really just to keep their job. And then there's others that are just trying to get through the day. They're trying to put out fires. And then there are truly those visionary people who you go to whenever you're down. They keep the organization moving. They have that sense of purpose and direction. And we all have a choice. Can I just maintain my own position? The next level is, can I just put out the fires of today and survive today? Or can I be somebody who, not the only person, but one of those people that whenever it's hard, we continue to push on in the direction that we go? And to me, as long as you're given valuable work to do in an organization and you have the ability to influence that organization in a positive way, that's really all you can ask for. You can make more money. You can certainly go to a more prestigious place. But I believe it was one of our rap friends who said, "More money, more problems." Sometimes it's not always what you want. So I think it's important for each individual person to figure those things out. And you know, can you stay behind the mission, vision, and values of the place? Is your biggest thing to move up? I guess there's nothing wrong with wanting to further your reach or your output. I think you just have to always ask the question, what is driving me to do that? And will ultimately I ever be satisfied in that pursuit? You know, I think it was Miley Cyrus who said, "It's about the climb." So we're quoting a lot of pop culture here, but in some ways it is. You have to figure out what will be personally fulfilling, because a long time ago, someone said it's all a chasing of the wind. So is your chasing of the wind something that whenever you finish with it, you will be satisfied with, or you can be satisfied with? I think that's the biggest thing. There is constant churn. Yes, the average CEO time is, 5 years? So they're hired to be fired at this point in healthcare. Yeah. So is there another way to do it? Are you confining yourself to moving around every 5 years? Or is there another path? I don't know.
Thanks. Well, I want to move on right now, and I appreciate the comments. I have a couple of questions specifically about your decision to pursue an MBA and those types of things. But Don Leiter has put a couple of questions in the comments, so let's take a look at that. Some comments and a question about the population health team and how that functions day to day at UK Healthcare. What does that look like?
Yeah, so within UK Healthcare, we want to ensure that with our population health team, in concentric circles, we go from our most vulnerable patients who are in our Medicaid program out all the way to our commercial insured patients. And virtually everyone at UK has some form of insurance. So that doesn't exclude anybody. So that is good. But we want to make sure that the most vulnerable and the most ill are actually making these appointments. So our pop health teams are pretty sophisticated. We have created a discharge clinic. So whenever a person gets discharged, someone is managing them for the first 30 days. How do we get them to the places that they want to be? With pop health, they are going through for all of the cohorted targeted patients and ensuring that the right ones are on statins, the right ones are their blood pressure is controlled, their A1C is where it needs to be. And how do we get them back into primary care? It does create a bit of a nanny state. Sometimes I feel like, shoot, I think we care more about your healthcare than you do, but that's a different set of issues. So that is how our pop health works here. I'm not sure that it's all that different than it does many places. It's just a key foundational piece of what we do to make sure that the system is working.
Great. Thank you. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about where you were in your career when you decided that pursuing an MBA would be advantageous for you.
Yeah. So the first thing is, I talk to people all the time and they're like, well, I don't have time to do it. You never have time. Just get over the idea that you have time to do it. So, and I realized, okay, I've got young kids in middle school, you know, now's not the time, but it was never going to get easier. And so I knew that on some level, this was a credential that I needed to have, and it was an exposure that I needed to have in order to do what I wanted to do. You can get the credential a lot of places, but you can't get the experience. The year that I spent with at Pembo, I would honestly say of the 25 years of professional existence, it probably was the best year of my life, because you grow really close to the people in your cohorts. One of the guys in our cohort, his wife died during the cohort. We were there with him. I love that guy to death. I just watching him and walking through that with him was a privilege. You know, it was like family. So there's that aspect of it. Only talking about things that pertain to healthcare and the things that matter to you are really important. You know, there are a lot of great MBA programs out there, but it's hard to translate manufacturing into the healthcare arena. I love the Shingo Institute stuff. We're trying to implement the Shingo management system in UK healthcare right now. But, you know, some of that just doesn't translate from manufacturing into healthcare. It's an awkward fit in some ways. And so Pemba just hits the nail right on the head. And the other thing is, it's the right length as well. It was never so onerous that I thought, I can't do this, I'm going to have to stop. But whenever we finished in December, I was glad to move on to a different rhythm in my life. So it was a great experience, the perfect setup, perfectly designed for physicians. It's great for physicians to get away for that 9-day period. It's better for you than you think. And if I could say one thing, I almost think that it would be better if they could completely disengage themselves from the phone to be away and totally immersed in what they were doing. I think they would actually get more out of it. I realize sometimes you can't do that, but that's why. So then I sat down with our CEO at the time, and he said, so I hear you want to do some administrative things. I'd already been doing quite a bit of administrative things. He just didn't know about it. And I said, yeah, I'm kind of interested in that. He goes, well, you need to get an MBA. And I was like, you know, interestingly, I have an MBA. He's like, oh, well, you need to get some experience. And I said, well, here's what I've been doing. And he's like, oh, okay. Well, you know, so it's more about objection handling. I hear people say, I'm going to get an MBA while I'm in med school. You don't know how you'd even apply it. It's a credential. But every day I was sitting there listening to people like Don Light or like Chuck Noon, especially Chuck Noon, you know, listening to Keith, listening to Professor Davies talk, and I was thinking, okay, here's how I'm going to use that, you know, whenever mm-hmm. I get back. Having that real-world application ongoing as I was doing it, that was the key. It was absolutely perfect.
So what was the biggest challenge with carving that year out from the standpoint? I mean, you said you found time to do it. What did you give up during that year in order to create the time, or did you just become better at time management?
Yeah. But what I gave up was all self-respect, because I've been a lifelong University of Kentucky fan. And other than the University of Louisville, I despise no one more than anyone wearing orange. So whenever they marched me down with a group of people into the bowels of Neyland Stadium to get a student ID, I felt like somebody who'd been taken away on the Inquisition. Okay, it would not have been worse, you know, if Torquemada had showed up and in orange and tried to torture me. But in all seriousness, so the biggest thing was, like, I remember sitting in some classes and being on the sideline of a soccer field. And so how do you balance being present in the moment with your family and being present in the moment with what's going on, with UT? They managed the balance really well. It was not as nearly what I thought it would be. It was much more manageable. And the time that was there on campus was completely maximized. And I think that's the real hidden value of the way the program works. You know, time management is important, but I did have to carve out some things that this is a priority, but it's very doable.
Great. Well, thanks for that. We're pretty much at the end of our time right now. It's 1 o'clock. So we're going to wrap up our live stream for today. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. And Jay, thank you again for the conversation, for sharing some of the lessons learned, the challenges that you see ahead for physician leaders and healthcare organizations, and specifically talking about the value that you got from the PEMBA program. Our next live stream is scheduled a month from today for October 15th. Dr. James Calvin, who has been on a previous podcast, will be our live stream guest for that show, discussing the creation of a Center for Quality, Safety, and Innovation in an academic department. PEMBA On Demand podcasts are also released bimonthly, on Thursdays. We will be releasing last month's live stream as a podcast this Thursday, September 19th. Dr. Harvey Castro discussed the dual role of AI and how it will impact and enhance our professional and personal lives, along with the lives of our patients. So please join us in 2 weeks, on October 3rd, for a show entitled Monetizing Medical Innovations, a guide for physician entrepreneurs with Dr. Hank Schiffers. And in 4 weeks, on October 17th, this live stream will be released in its podcast format. Please visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PEMBAOnDemand for the schedule of future live streams. And please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast player. Thanks again for joining us, and I hope you all have a great day. If you enjoyed this episode of PEMBA On Demand, taken from our live stream on September 17th with Dr. Jay Greider. We discussed a wide variety of topics from different perspectives. I had a great time interviewing Jay and learning from him and his experience. PEMBA On Demand podcasts are released bimonthly on Thursdays. Please join us in 2 weeks on October 31st, 2024. Our guest will be Dr. Francois Nader, a PEMBA alum from the year 2000. Dr. Nader has had a long career in the medical industry, focusing on immunology and vaccine development. At the time the COVID vaccine was developed, he was on the board and chair of the board for Moderna. He has served on many boards and led companies through mergers and acquisitions also. I'm sure that you will enjoy the comments and the interview that I have with Dr. Nader. The next podcast, we will have Dr. James Calvin as our guest. Dr. Calvin was on a previous podcast and is also appearing on our October 15th live stream. We will be repurposing the live stream for the podcast on November 14th. Dr. Calvin will be presenting on developing a center for quality, safety, and innovation in an academic center. Please visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PEMBAON-demand, no spaces, for the schedule of future live streams. Please subscribe to the channel. Please also find us on your favorite podcast player. We would appreciate your support and leaving any comments that you have on the website for us to review. We appreciate hearing from you. And thank you once again for joining our podcast today. That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.